28, if you care to turn there in your Bibles, there is the record of an event that occurred very close to the end of King Saul's life. You remember perhaps that King Saul was the first king of the United Kingdom, and while he may have begun well in some ways, it wasn't long before he began to disobey God. And the text says that the Spirit of the Lord departed from him. In chapter 28 of 1 Samuel, we find the Philistines have gathered together, and Saul wants to know what will be the outcome of the battle. The Lord wasn't speaking to Saul anymore. He wasn't giving him information as he had in the past, perhaps. And so Saul takes a drastic step. He goes and he consults the witch at Endor. Saul had been responsible for removing such individuals from Israel in the past, and now he finds himself seeking her information, or seeking information from her. And 1 Samuel 28 tells us that when Saul comes to her, he requests that she consult Samuel, who had Prophet Samuel, who had already died. It seems to me that when Samuel appears, that the woman is surprised. She apparently did not expect that to happen. And Samuel, beginning in verse 15, said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" And Saul answered, "I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called you, that you may reveal to me what I should do." And Samuel said, "So why do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? And the Lord has done for himself as he spoke to me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David." Of course, David had already been anointed by Samuel in the past, and Saul has even tried to kill David on a number of occasions. Verse 18 continues, Samuel says, "Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines." The worst possible news. The nation's going to be defeated by their perennial enemies, the Philistines. And you, Saul, and your sons are going to die. You will be with me tomorrow. The reaction of Saul in verse 20 is interesting. Immediately Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day or all night. He hadn't eaten. But I think part of his weakness was that he had gotten news that caused him to be so afraid that he just falls out on the ground, full length. Fear is hard to describe as an emotion. Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever tried to describe exactly what fear is? It seems that when we try to define fear, more often than not, what we end up doing is describing its symptoms or the things that are caused by fear. Even Webster does that to some extent. Let me read you some definitions of fear by Webster. He says that fear is a painful emotion marked by alarm, dread, disquiet, he says. Also an instance of this feeling. But he gives some other definitions of fear. He says that fear is the state or habit of fearing, anxious concern, solicitude. But he gives another definition, and that is that fear can mean awe or a profound reverence, especially, Webster writes, for the supernatural being. Did you notice that Webster talks about what fear does to us? Fear's hard to describe in terms of defining, but the Bible uses the word fear with more than one meaning, and even in the same sense that Webster defines it, the Bible sometimes uses the word fear to mean terror or fright. Like we talk about being afraid of of goblins or something of that nature. In fact, in Matthew, the 14th chapter, when the disciples saw Jesus walking on the water toward the boat, they were terrified. They thought they were seeing a ghost, a spirit. And so they were dreadfully afraid. But the Bible also uses the word fear, the same word for that matter in the Greek language, to refer to reverence or respect or awe. What's the whole duty of man, according to Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13? It is to fear God and keep His commandments. And the word fear that I believe means to have reverence for God and as a result to obey Him. In Proverbs, the first chapter, verse 7, as the writer of Proverbs sets the foundation of his comments about wisdom, he says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." Fear there doesn't mean terror. It means reverence. It means awe. As we're going to note a little bit later on, I believe fear is a legitimate motivator. But this morning I would like to focus more on the negative aspect of the power of fear. And I think one of the best illustrations of that is in the Gospels. It is the story of Peter's denials of the Lord. If you'll be turning in your Bibles to the 14th chapter of Mark in just a few moments, we'll be talking about Peter's threefold denial of the Lord. But as you're turning, let me suggest to you that my purpose this morning also is to talk about how we can overcome fear. Fear can be paralyzing and can cause us not to do what we know we should. I believe that the account of Peter's denial of his master is a perfect illustration of the power of fear, particularly as we look at the circumstances surrounding those denials. Jesus, in Mark, the 14th chapter, and verse 30, had predicted that Peter would in fact deny him. Verse 30 of Mark 14 says that Jesus said to him, that is to Peter in particular, "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." What an incredible prophecy, especially concerning a man who has just said in verse 29 to the Lord, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." Peter said, "Lord, maybe the rest of them will be scattered like sheep, but not me." And the Lord made this incredible prophecy concerning Peter. Who would have guessed that one who loved the Lord as much as Peter obviously did, and that's evident on a number of occasions, that one like that would deny Jesus three times? And yet the prophecy obviously is fulfilled, as were all the prophecies of Jesus. In the 14th chapter of Mark, just a little bit later on in the text, after Jesus has been arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane and he has been transported into Jerusalem, and he's in the courtyard or in the high priest's palace there, we find out in verse 66 that Peter has come into the courtyard. We're told in John's Gospel that another disciple had gained entrance into that courtyard for Peter. All the disciples had been scattered, but Peter and another disciple had followed afar off. And now Peter has come into the courtyard in the very location or very near where Jesus is being interrogated by the leaders of the Jews. But as he is below in the courtyard, verse 66 says, "One of the servant girls of the high priest came. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were with Jesus of Nazareth.'" Now what's interesting about that is that when the other disciple who had gained entrance into the courtyard for Peter, and I believe it was John, when that happened, it's obvious from the servant girl's comment she knew that John was one of Jesus' disciples. Did you notice here in verse 66, or 67 rather, that she said, "You also were with Jesus of Nazareth"? She's referring to John. But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you are saying." He went out on the porch and a rooster crowed. So he moved away after having denied Jesus the first time. And the servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, "This is one of them." But he denied it again. And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter again, Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean, and your speech shows it. Now, there were other Galileans in Jerusalem at the time, but it was apparently known that, with the possible exception of Judas, all the disciples, all the apostles were Galileans. And someone said, "You talk like a Galilean. You were one of his disciples. Your speech shows it." Then he began to curse and swear, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." A second time the rooster crowed. Then Peter called to mind the word that Jesus had said to him, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." And when he thought about it, he wept. Luke says that after the third denial, Jesus looked at him. And Peter was reminded of the Lord's prophecy and how he had fulfilled that prophecy just moments before. Now, I believe that Peter's denials were the result of his fear. Despite his affirmation of loyalty, beginning back in verse 27 of this chapter in Mark 14, Jesus said to the disciples, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it's written, 'I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." And Peter said, as we already read, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." Going on down to verse 31, following the prophecy of Jesus, Peter spoke more vehemently, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." Peter says, "That's my commitment, even to the death." And yet in the same night, he not only denies that he is a disciple, he denies that he even knows Jesus. And as his speech had betrayed him as a disciple, he changes his speech. Begins to curse and to give oaths that he is not a disciple of Jesus. Now, lest we be unfair with Peter, the text says they all said the same thing. All the disciples made this commitment of loyalty and courage. It's interesting to me that while all the disciples were together and the Lord was there, that Peter made these kinds of statements, this kind of commitment. But notice the different circumstances when Peter denies the Master. They've been to the garden, and the group came with weapons, and they've taken Jesus, and it's become apparent to the disciples, finally, they're finally, I think, realizing that Jesus is in trouble, that the leaders of the Jews want to kill him. Peter's in the courtyard. These are the enemies, some who had been out on the Mount of Olives and had helped arrest Jesus, and Peter's right in the middle of them. And I believe he feared for his own life. In the Garden of Gethsemane, it's interesting that it was Peter who drew his sword and lopped off the ear of the high priest's servant, Malchus. John tells us that in chapter 18, verse 10. And when you look at that, it may be that we're tempted to think that Peter was very courageous here and that somehow he had a lapse later on, but I would remind you that sometimes fear causes individuals to overreact. It's clear that Peter had overreacted as the Lord rebukes him for his action. I wonder if that's why Peter did what he did. It was not so much a matter of courage as it was a matter of extreme fear. And so he pulls a sword and begins swinging and hurting others. But when all is said and done, Mark 14 and verse 15 says that Peter fled with the rest, even after he had wielded the sword, at least in defense of himself, if not in defense of the Lord. What is it that you fear? I think there are some rather common causes of fear. I believe probably the most common thing about fear is the unknown, uncertainty. I believe that's why people fear death. We don't know. We've not been there, unless, of course, you've seen the light and then came back and you were able to tell the tabloids all about it. But for the rest of us, it's something we've never experienced. We don't get any first-hand reports back from those that we know who have died. It is the uncertainty of the grave that I think makes people at least to some extent afraid. Hebrews the second chapter talks about that. That men live in fear of death for even other reasons besides the unknown or the uncertainty of it. I believe that's why Peter denied the Lord. He was afraid he was going to die. And he may have had just cause for that. I think the fear of the future is again the unknown, the uncertainty. Fear of ostracism, being shunned or not belonging, sometimes causes people to do things as a result of fear. You remember the account in Galatians, the second chapter, where again it was Peter along with Barnabas who played the hypocrite because some Jewish Christians had come and he separated himself from the Gentiles. And Paul rebuked him, he says in Galatians 2, to his face. He played the hypocrite because he was afraid that he wouldn't belong, that he would be rejected. I think fear of rejection causes many people not to tell their neighbors about Jesus Christ. We're afraid of what people will say. We're afraid of criticism. Have you ever thought about how many things we do day by day and just mundane things sometimes based on what people will think? Do you ever find yourself when you're in public and you're doing something and you are conscious of the fact that others are watching you, and so you do something in a specific way because you're afraid maybe of what they might think if you did it some other way? I think a lot of people's fears arise from their concern about what others will think about them. Will they think I'm not very smart or that I'm not cool or whatever? Fear of pain, physical pain or discomfort. How many people are afraid of the dentist? The dentist is our friend. Isn't that right, Craig? Especially if he's family. How many of you have heard that commercial on the radio of the, what was the little girl's name? I can't remember her name now all of a sudden. And she's constantly talking about how people are afraid to go to the dentist. I would, if I could do anything to get that commercial off, it's been on for like 2 years. I'm so sick of it. But she's absolutely right. A lot of people are scared to death to go to the dentist because they think it's going to be painful and they anticipate that and it causes fear. Fear of failure. Sometimes are afraid to do something for fear that we might not do it right or not do it well. Even in Bible classes, sometimes people won't make comments because they're afraid they might get the wrong answer. We're afraid of failure. I said earlier, I think fear can be a legitimate motivation. In fact, I would encourage you to turn over to Matthew, the 10th chapter, and notice a comment that Jesus made as he spoke to his disciples about fear. In verse 28 of Matthew 10, he said, "And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." And the word fear here, I'm not sure means reverence or awe, but I mean, I think it has that definition of anxious concern. You need to be concerned about the one who can actually destroy both body and soul, not just take your physical life. But I will tell you that I think love is the higher motivation, the greater motivation. And here's why I say that. Those who are motivated by fear will do only that which is necessary to avoid punishment. But the one who's motivated by love cannot do enough and will go beyond even what is necessary, so to speak, to avoid punishment. I'll tell you some of the results of fear. Like Peter and Barnabas, it'll cause us to play the hypocrite. It caused Abraham and his son Isaac on separate occasions to lie about their wives. They were afraid that they were going to be killed for their wives' sake. Fear causes us to fail to reach our full potential when we're afraid to do something or try something because we might fail. Fear can cause us to fail to do good. Fear causes us to lose sight of the larger issue or the larger picture. I think that's the problem with the dentist or the doctor. Sometimes being afraid of pain or the unknown can cause a person not to seek treatment for an illness that could in fact have been treated, which ends up killing them. They were afraid of the treatment. They lost sight of the bigger picture. The temporary discomfort of the treatment would have been well worth the benefit of having your life prolonged, perhaps in a physical way. As we noted in Matthew, the 10th chapter, in verse 28, Jesus said, don't worry about the ones. Don't be afraid of the ones who can only take a physical life. The bigger picture is that what happens to your soul is more important. Fear the one who can destroy both body and soul. He's talking about God in hell. In fact, if you turn over to Revelation, the 21st chapter, in verse 8, a passage that probably many of us are quite familiar with, Revelation chapter 21, verse 8, we find out that in truth, fear can cause us to be lost for eternity. Of all the things that would be listed to talk about being sins responsible for people being punished for eternity, listen to chapter 21, verse 8. But the cowardly, or the fearful, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Cowards are grouped with the murderers and the sexually immoral, the pedophiles, and the perverts. The cowards are right there. Fear will cause us to be lost. I have gone back and forth in my own mind about whether fear in the sense of alarm or concern is really a God-given emotion. I suspect that it is. I had an interesting experience. We went just this last week to South Carolina, and I watched a little girl, a toddler, go out on the beach and just walk down into the waves. I think she would have kept on going. Her mother hadn't stopped her. She knew no fear at all. Is it something that we learn with time as we begin to understand the consequences of actions? Or is it a God-given emotion? But I'll tell you, whichever way it is, fear can serve some good purposes. A little fear will make you a better public speaker. Fear causes some physical changes, makes the adrenaline start to pump. The heart beats faster. Your digestion stops because all that blood's needed for other purposes, fear or flight, fight or flight. Your eyes dilate in fear. Fear can cause us to avoid physical dangers. Growing up, some of my high school buddies used to do some really dumb things. And you know how high school guys are, you know, they'll challenge each other. What's the matter? You're afraid? Well, yeah, because I know what the consequence is. I prefer to think of it as wisdom, not fear, but in a sense it's fear. It's an understanding of the consequences, and that's how fear operates for us. The Bible even notes that. Number of passages we could talk about, but one that is a favorite of mine. Deuteronomy 21, verse 21. You know what you did with the rebellious son under the old law? I don't know that it happened very often, but the law said if a son wouldn't listen to his parents, if he was a drunkard and all that, they took him out and they stoned him. And the text says in Deuteronomy 21, 21, that it was done so that others would fear. I think my dad used that principle. He'd spank one of us so that the others would fear. You ever heard the parent say, spank the kid next to my kid and my kid will be afraid and will shape up? It's the principle of seeing what happens and changing your behavior. Same thing in 1 Timothy the 5th chapter, verse 20, where Paul says that elders who sin need to be rebuked before all that the others may fear. Fear can be a positive motivator. But see, here's the thing. When fear is uncontrolled, when it is excessive, then it can rob our lives of joy and contentment, and it can be, at least in part or maybe even totally, debilitating. It causes us not to be what we ought to be. It paralyzes us so that we don't do the good that we should. Well, how do we overcome fear? How do we deal with fear? Well, I think part of the solution is to recognize the cause of our fear. Have you ever noticed that when you're afraid, it's usually because we're involved pretty much only with ourselves? Have you noticed that when people are looking inward with too much intensity, they become afraid? But when people focus on the needs of others, they become courageous. I dare say Bill's grandson has seen that perhaps in the military, where people sometimes perform great acts of bravery. It's not that they're not afraid, it's that they are now concerned about others. They see a bigger picture than just their own safety, their own lives. And so at least, in a sense, they're able to forget the danger to their own personal safety because they're focusing on something else outside of themselves. That may be an important principle to remember. Perhaps we could overcome some of our fears if we lost ourselves in the service of Christ. I think fear, a lot of fear, is caused by a lack of knowledge or by what we imagine. When I was growing up, in our house, there was a laundry room, and in order to get to the only bathroom in the house, you had to go past the laundry room. The laundry room had a window there, and in the night, the moon sometimes would shine through that window and it'd create shadows in the room. I can remember becoming so adept at getting from the dining room to the bathroom in a split second so that nothing that was lingering around the corner. There was a water heater back there that just, you know, as a kid, it was kind of mysterious stuff. And I just knew there was somebody going to be hiding back there who's going to grab me. And I could zip into that bathroom. I never hit the wall. I could get right around. I didn't waste any time. My imagination was creating fear. Fear is often caused by a lack of knowledge. I read a story about a woman who had just returned from a trip from Mexico, and she called the police, the Los Angeles police. And she reported that there was a rattlesnake that was loose in her overnight bag. She thought she'd picked this snake up in Mexico. The police went rushing to the scene of her house with sirens screaming, and they approached the bag. The woman had heaved out of the window onto the sidewalk, and so they grabbed the bag and they scattered the contents, and she had an electric toothbrush that had turned on. It hadn't bitten her yet, but she was absolutely sure there was a poisonous snake, rattler, in that purse. How many of our fears turn out to be nothing? But our imagination, our lack of knowledge of understanding what really is going on, creates things that are dangerous, or at least we think are dangerous. Sometimes fears are just simply excuses. You remember the story of the talents, the parable of the talents that Jesus told in Matthew, the 25th chapter? And there was that man who had the one talent. The other two had gone out and they invested the money they had been given, and they received return interest and brought it to the master when he called for their accounting. But that one talent man, he went and he buried his. And what he says to his master is, "I was afraid." The master said, "You wicked and lazy servant." He didn't give him any points for being afraid. He called him wicked. I think sometimes fears are just excuses. Now, there are other fears that are genuine, but that can be controlled. I think fear is also caused, in many cases, by a lack of faith. In Hebrews, the 13th chapter, there's a statement there in verses 5 and 6 that I want you to consider with me as we move to the close of our study. Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 and 6. And I want you to look at this passage as essentially a foundation for the reading in Joshua chapter 1. In Hebrews 13, verse 5, the writer says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me?" When Israel came to the promised land, and Moses has died, he's not allowed to go into the promised land, and Joshua now, in chapter 1 of Joshua, has become the leader of the people. He'll bring the nation in. It's interesting to me that in chapter 1 of Joshua, the Lord speaks to Joshua and says on at least two clear occasions, "Be strong and very courageous." But did you notice the reason why? "For I am with you. I will not forsake you." The reason that Joshua was to be courageous was that he could depend on the Lord. Do you understand that when the nation came into the land, if they fought against some of the people of the land and they lost, they had no place to go. They didn't have any fortified cities. They didn't belong anywhere. They were nomads. In fact, there were people who had been slaves the previous generation. It was important for them to come into the land believing that God was going to take care of them. And that's how courage arrives. That was kind of interesting in Gary's prayer. He talked about the fact that when we come together, we do so at least in part to encourage one another. Ever thought about that word? Encourage. What happens when we come together here is that, at least ideally, we are providing one another, stimulating in one another courage to do the right thing, not to be afraid, to remember that God is with us. I love the words of David in 1 Samuel, the 17th chapter. That's the passage that describes the battle between him and the Philistine champion, Goliath. David has come to visit his brothers who are serving in the army. David was the youngest. He was still at home taking care of things. And when he finds out that Goliath is confronting the nation of God's people and nobody's responding to the challenge, David volunteers to do that. And I want you to pick up with me, if you will, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 34. David's been brought to Saul. And Saul says, you can't fight this guy. You're just a youth. And David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth, and when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul says, "Go and the Lord be with you." I have a cousin who likes to hunt bears. He's hunted them with a bow. He's hunted them with rifles. But I don't think he's ever gone to Alaska with a stick to kill a bear. David said, "The lion came, the bear came, and I went after him without a 150 grain bullet that could travel so many miles an hour, or a bow that had broad heads that could cut a slice through an animal. He went out with a staff, a stick, but he said, 'The Lord was with me.'" And that's why a little bit later on in the chapter, go over now to verse 43, when David comes out against Goliath, the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air, and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there's a God in Israel." You think David was afraid? I don't know how he could have avoided being at least a little bit afraid, but he understood that God was with him, and that's how he mastered his fear. That's how he handled it. And that's how we'll handle our fears. Whether it's the unknown or fear of failure or criticism or ostracism or any of the other things that we talked about earlier. Back to King Saul. You remember in 1 Samuel 28? Samuel said, "Tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." And he just fell out. He had good reason to be afraid. He'd been unfaithful. He'd been rebellious. The kingdom was being yanked away from him. He needed to be afraid of death. A fellow by the name of Sewell made this observation. He said, "Fear is the tax that conscience pays to guilt." You understand that? Fear is the tax that conscience pays to guilt. For people who have who are guilty of sin, they have every reason to be afraid, especially of death. A Christian shouldn't be filled with fear. As Paul wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy 1, verse 7, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of a sound mind." Confidence excludes fear, and love brings confidence. John said in 1 John 4, verses 17 through 19. You know, some people are actually afraid to obey the gospel. They're afraid, perhaps, to take such a big step. Maybe because they're unsure, that uncertainty thing, if they can follow through. If I obey the gospel, if I become a Christian, what if I can't do it? What if I can't live the life of a Christian? I'll wait until I'm stronger. I'll tell you, some people are actually just afraid of being the focus of a crowd. Afraid to come to the front, the invitation song, because others will be watching them. Well, I'd make two observations. The first one is that there's not really anything in the Scriptures that says you have to obey the gospel in an assembly of the saints. Maybe we've left the wrong impression with people, if that's what they believe. But the other thing I would tell you is, I really can't imagine a more sympathetic and supportive crowd. You're going to stand before a crowd and confess Christ. This would be a good group. In the book of Acts, in chapter 24, you may recall that Paul was a prisoner of the Romans, and he appeared before a couple of Roman governors. In chapter 24, he appeared before Felix, and he preached to Felix about, as the text says, righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. Text says Felix was afraid. Well, he had reason to be afraid. He was an ungodly individual. I said before, I think fear is a legitimate motivation. And some people will obey the gospel just simply because they're afraid to die. They are afraid of the consequence of dying in their condition. But I think love is the greater motivation. And I wonder if that's not the reason that we take the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. By example, is that the Lord's Supper reminds us of the great love that God had for us, as Craig talked about, in sending His Son to die for us. Love is the higher motivation. We love Him because He first loved us. You're outside of Christ. You've never obeyed the gospel. You've never been baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins. Then why not allow your love for God and your understanding of the identity of Jesus as the Son of God to cause you, to motivate you to obey the gospel? Why not now, as we stand and sing, to invite you?